to do anything special? Or?
No, just
be as out.
Well, good morning. If you want to get up and get coffee while I'm talking, or for any other reason, feel free to do it. It won't bother me at all. And I'll certainly try to leave a few minutes at the end for questions, or you can ask me whenever you see me around the church. Ruth and I came to Winchester in 1970 without children. And if you've been around New England for any period of time, you know that it's got a culture and a geographical socioeconomic makeup that's a lot different than other regions in the country. One thing about a town like Winchester is it's very parochial, very insulated, so things that go on in Winchester really aren't known about in towns like Lexington and Stoneham, and that says a lot about how you're going to impact a town. And, Ruth became Christian through missionaries in Taiwan, and so her focus is very evangelistic, wants to bring people into Christ's family, and that was certainly my focus. And so when we arrived here, we looked around for something right on site that would be a basis for an evangelistic type of ministry that we could have that would also offer what the McFarlands were looking for as far as the children are concerned, something that would give their children a good basis, our children a good basis in the fundamentals of the faith. And there just wasn't really anything here that met that criterion. And so, as Ian mentioned, a lot of us went to churches out of town. There are a lot of, you go across the town of Winchester, and there is still a sizable cohort of people that go to Grace Chapel, Park Street Church, and some other churches, but those are the two main ones. And we ended up for 21 years at Grace Chapel. And during that period of time, from 1970 onward, Ruth and I decided that we should pray about starting something on a corporate basis here in Winchester. Because how are you going to impact a town? You have various options, like starting a Bible study, but that's a limited group of people. It would be people that you have an affinity for because of your who you are, or you just have so much time you can devote to that type of a ministry. My wife might have started, and she did, have things for children, like a neighborhood Bible study. She did Pioneer Girls at one point. But those have limited impact on a town like Winchester. So our focus was really on this town and what we're going to do with this town. And all the time we were over in Grace Chapel, we were praying about doing something here in Winchester. And at night, we knew a lot of people, in fact, probably most of the people that were attending Grace Chapel from the town. And so in 1980, we had been heavily involved at Grace at all different levels. And in 1980, we invited everybody we knew from the town to start a Bible study. And we started meeting, and we were studying about the disciples, and our focus was, gee, we would really like to think about starting a church here in Winchester. We've been praying about it, but it soon turned out that the other members of the group were really more interested in Grace and not didn't really have our vision for the town, and that petered out. And so we went back and renewed our involvement at Grace. Continued praying about it. And in about end of 1992, 1993, Andy Mills and I started talking. Andy was living down on Church Street and opposite the Christian Science Church, and we spoke about maybe doing something on a corporate basis. He and Gail, particularly Andy, was a fairly new Christian at that time, and we got to know each other. And there were some fairly mature Christians at that point, different people, entirely different people that Andy's circle of friends and my circle of friends would overlap with. So we decided in January of 1993, early January, to invite two other couples to a meeting. And we had four couples at this meeting at Andy Mills' home. in early January of 1993. And one of the couples was Stan and Ginger Oakes. And Stan was the head of the Christian Leadership Ministries of Campus Crusade. He developed that ministry, and he was the head of it. And Stan said, let's have a Super Bowl party. You know, we're having a Super Bowl party in a couple of weeks. February 6th, I think it is. That Super Bowl party had its genesis in January, in that meeting in January 1993. So we're going to have a Super Bowl party, invite everybody we know to this party with the idea that we're thinking about starting a church in Winchester. It wasn't limited to just Winchesterites. Anyone can come. We'll have the party, and then at the halftime, we'll just have a little conversation about whether people want to at least think about the idea. And so we did throw the Super Bowl party. If you're coming down Johnson Road onto Warwick Street in Winchester, crossing Cambridge Street, the fourth house on the left is a white house, big white house, and that house is where Hope Christian Church started, in the living room of Stan Oakes' rented home. He and Ginger were renting at that time. And so we held a Super Bowl party, had about 30 to 35 adults and a lot of kids. Just like we have here, there were a whole pile of kids in another room. We held our meeting, and we expressed the idea that, gee, we'd like to start an afternoon church service where people be interested. And we talked about it, and we said, yeah, let's just try it and see what it's like, with the idea that maybe we'd start a church. Either the next Sunday or the following Sunday. We agreed we'd meet at 4:00 in the afternoon. The idea would be there'd be no conflicts. Most of the people were Grace Chapel people, but there were a few people from time to time that come in from other churches that heard about what we were doing, and it was a group of around 30 to 35 people. The service was structured somewhat like what we do today, but a little different. Stan Oakes would do a lot of the teaching, but there'd be others that would from time to time teach. We'd have a nugget, which was like Todd's children's story, but anyone could do it. And we'd have children doing it. It was a 5-minute story. And a lot of singing, meet for about an hour and 15 minutes, get over about 5:15. And we did that starting in early February of 1993. So we're going along for about 6 weeks, and people started to say, gee, this is probably a pretty good idea. We're interested in doing something a little more concrete. We need some more chairs anyway. Maybe we should, so we can funnel our money through on a tax-deductible basis. Let's incorporate. So in April of 1993, we incorporated. Formed a steering committee and started drafting our bylaws, our statement of faith, and our mission statement. Bought our chairs. We didn't have a big budget. We're not paying anybody at this point for speaking or any rental arrangement. It's just all our expenses were really, if we happened to have a food need or something like that, we're paying for things like that. But it was mainly just to get started. So we're incorporated in April 1993, and soon after that, sometime I think it was in April, one afternoon, and there was a knock on the door, and someone went to the door. This is in the middle of the service, and it's the Winchester Police Department, and the Winchester Police Department wants to know what's going on here. How come? And every Sunday afternoon, about 3:45, all of these cars show up, and we got cars all over the Wildwood Street and one of the side streets. And so we decided at that point, that's a zoning issue, because you're really not supposed to be running something on a regular corporate basis. And we really weren't at that point. We really weren't in violation. But now that we're incorporated, we really should, we felt we should move to something more on a regular meeting basis in a building that's really suitable for that, a public facility. So starting in May of 1993, We met over here at the First Baptist Church, same time, in their bottom floor there. And we met in there from May of 1993 to the end of August 1993. Now, we're paying rental. Wasn't a big amount, but we did pay rental there. Now, let me back off on that. They gave that to us free. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was free. But I do think we gave them something because of the fact that they've given us the space to use. And so that worked out okay. And so now, but during that period of time, the steering committee is working on these documents. And what you see is the bylaws are, with a few tweaks, basically what came out of the steering committee. The statement of faith is the statement of faith from Wheaton College in Illinois, with one or two changes, and the mission statement was reworked. It's not radically different, but it's different format with different emphases. So the documents are pretty much what have existed for the last 17, 18 years almost. And in June, July time frame, we started saying to people, okay, we really think we will move to a morning service in September of 1993. Those people who have been considering whether or not this is going to be the church, now is the time to start making decisions. And we looked around for space. We were able to contract with the town of Winchester to rent the space up at the Lynch School, which I'll describe in a minute. We told everybody that we would be meeting with a regular Sunday school and regular service. We'd be starting just like we do today with a 9:30 time frame and finishing around 12:15. At that point, we had a steering committee of eight. We instituted a board of elders of six in about July of 1993. September of 1993, we did move to Lynch School. Now, Lynch School is a very interesting complex. If you know anything about it, it's probably built in the late 50s, early 60s, but it's it has a gymnasium lunchroom combination. That's where we met, and you have to get a picture of what it was like. If I'm at the front of it, there's a stage behind me with the curtain you're all familiar with, and the person who's at the pulpit is speaking out this way. There's a big glass wall over here. This is important. Big glass wall here, and then classrooms over here. And there are two doors that go through the glass wall, and there's a little atrium outside the glass wall. And it's got cherry trees in it. Well, you say, why is that important? Well, what would happen would be during the week, particularly in the winter, but probably all year round, they'd open those doors, and sometimes there'd be birds that would feed on those cherries. And when we get in there on Sunday morning, the birds would be flying around in the gymnasium. So whoever's speaking, you've got this distraction of all of a sudden a bird going from this side of this big room to this side of this big room and back again. And there's no way, even if you open the doors, that it's going to go out, because it's looking for something higher, and it's got this light up here, and it bounces against the window, so you got that distraction. Then, and of course in the winter, you never want to open the doors, because everyone will scream bloody murder that it's too cold. Another thing about the school was we'd come in many mornings, and we'd get there at 8 to set up, because you set up the chairs, and they gave us a place to put all of our stuff, our sound system, so we'd put it all out, but it would take a good hour and 15 minutes to set everything up. And we had three other classrooms, and you'd have to set those up and make sure people didn't get into what the teachers would not want you to be getting into. So there were logistical issues about setting up the school every day and taking it all down. So another little distraction, not so little, was that in that window wall, there used to be one or more crows who would decide to land on the top level of the windows, and they would peck at the window. So here's whoever's speaking. All of a sudden, you get this this constant pecking going on. And there are many sunny services where people would have their coats on because it was not quite warm enough. The advantage of being in that school, we only had to pay for the hours we were in there. We paid for the custodian for the hours that he worked. So as opposed to a commercial building where you have to pay for a weekly rent, you're paying all week long. So it worked out well for us in that situation. But in the summer, as you probably know if you have kids, what they do is they clean out all the classrooms and redo the floors and everything. So when that school has no air conditioning, save for one window unit in the library. So we'd move into the library. Now it's a flat top school, so they can get very hot. So people would have to come through the main door, go through all of the desks and everything down the hallway and into the library. Now, that wasn't such a good deal, especially for new visitors. So this is hardcore right now. The people who are coming know that you have the sense that we're fly by night. And if you're new, you're saying, gee, do I really want to put up with this? And then one of the summers, they decided to re-roof the school. And so there was all of this debris coming down over all of the furniture that was like an gritty ash. And we had to walk through that. So we went through 4 years there. And while we're going through the first year, we did have a number of outside speakers. Walt Kaiser from Gordon Conwell's president spoke to us, and a number of other people. And there were people in the congregation that spoke. Dan Smick spoke quite a bit. We had a full Sunday school, but we were from about 94, 95 looking for other space. I'll get back to that in a minute. During 93-94, the winter of 93-94, we decided we needed a full-time pastor. And one of the people who was an elder, also on the search committee, head of the search committee, Scott Stevenson, was a partner with Boston Consulting Group, so he knew how to do a search. Now, he has this group of people right now who have probably 40 adults at most with maybe 25 children, who's going to come to pastor a church like that with meeting in a school? Well, Scott knew how to do a search, and we got 150 resumes, and we finally called Ray Bandai, who was at Pacific Palisades, California, in a church, Calvary Church in Pacific Palisades. He had been an interim minister there. Previous minister had been Howard Clark. If you know anything about Grace Chapel, Howard Clark was the head minister at Grace Chapel during the early 90s. Ray came with his four children and his wife, and we told them that we could give them 2 years' salary. That's all we could promise them. But he came all the way across country. We rented a house for him. Here in Winchester, and Ray was our teaching elder from end of August 1993 to the end of August 2007. He was one of our emphasis in setting up Hope Christian Church was we wanted to be a church that taught about the Bible. We just thought it was really important that people learn what the Bible was all about, that there was a real need for that in the culture at large. Ray had been with Navigators, was a teacher as opposed to, say, an expositional type of preacher like, say, Todd, and was very good at laying out what a passage had to say verse by verse. So he was just what we needed, and he attracted a lot of people who really were fed by that method of teaching. Of course, Todd has been here since June of 2008, came from Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, as he said, and we had, just to show you the difference, we had over 400 resumes for that position, he is our teaching elder. The search for a place to meet was a difficult one because while we were drawing from largely from Winchester, maybe at this point about 60% from Winchester, 40% from other towns. Winchester is a small town geographically, and there are only really three places to build. And Andy and I were have been looking around, Andy and I and Scott, for a place. And one place is the old Winning Farm up on the west side of Winchester. And so we made an application to the town because the town acquired a part of that land and was going to allow some of it to be developed and put most of it in conservation land. So we made an application to build there. And our building costs are going to be about $100 a square foot. And we knew that there was a Jewish synagogue that also wanted a place in town. And so the idea was we were going to share a parking lot, and they would have their facility, and we would have our facility as part of the Winning Farm land that was going to be sold off by the town of Winchester. And that's what we proposed, and they looked on it favorably, but didn't make any final decision. There was a big, there was a groundswell of interest in having a senior center, assisted living type center there, assisted living facility. And so the town took our plan under advisement, and you know, when you get involved in politics, things don't always move that quickly. I think they broke ground. That was in the winter of 1997 that Andy and I met with the town board. They ended up building on that property, starting construction, I think, about 3 years ago. So we would have been waiting till about 2007, a 10-year wait, and fortunately, the Lord provided something, another alternative. Second place that was available was the property opposite Mahoney's, that's on Route 3 at Cambridge Street, that's being built on right now. That there's about 7 acres there. Problem that with that location is a lot of it is wetland, and the price for that was very steep as far as what we could afford. And the third place was on the east side of town. It was an old industrial facility, and it had some toxic waste problems. So all of the places we might have built on all had difficulties. So we prayed, and we looked at other facilities to rent. We looked over on the East Street area, and we're talking to everybody we could find. The Lord did provide this building, and I'll get to that in just a second once I get through a few more details on what happened up at Lynch. Lynch School, this whole area is, as you know, there's a lot of mobility in this area, and particularly if you go to a place like Grace Chapel, you see it. When we were there, it would turn over, about one-third of the church would turn over about every 3 years. It was just a huge number of people going in and out. That's because of the academic community, the medical community. People come here to study, get a master's, finish their PhD, and then they're gone. And our church in the early years was no exception. We had a lot of people. There were Tufts at Harvard. They were in the military. They were here just for one-year study. A lot of them very mature Christians, but it's very hard to build a church like that. And so many years in the spring in that library at that school, every weekend we'd be saying goodbye to one or two families. And we'd go up to 65, 70 people, and then we'd fall back to 40, 45 people. There's one year that we literally lost about half of our people. And it wasn't people leaving the church, because most of the people were sort of hardcore people, because you have to be to be in that situation relative to a school that's not really designed to be a church. And so that was difficult. We also had access to, there is another gym at the Lynch School where we would have the toddlers go, and they'd run around during the sermon there. One day, all of a sudden, the fire alarm goes off. So, you know, when that fire alarm goes off in a school, you're going to get all the fire engines and everything happens. And we're in the library at this point, and what happened is one of the kids in that gym, which is about 50 yards to the left of the library, pulled the alarm. And his father went in and picked him up, and I can still see him. He was about 5 years old, and he was the type of kid that when you looked at him, you knew he was, he could think faster than you could. Very smart little kid, Dan Smick's son. And his father had him like this, and he was still wiggling. So Lynch School was a challenge, and we did have our, as every church does, we've had our issues over time, and a lot of them involve people issues, but it was a growing time and maturing time, and we came out of that. In many ways, it was a crucible. But in April of 1997, we heard about this facility. This facility was, at that point, a Knights of Columbus facility. But let me take you back to what has transpired on the site, at least since the late 1800s, because it's important for you to understand where this building comes from, because it does have an interesting history. In the late 1800s, there was a shingle-framed building on this site. It looked like a typical church that you'd see, a typical sort of Methodist church. That would be my thinking of it. The little spire and a stained glass window, sort of a half moon in the front, a nice little church. And it was the Episcopal church in town. And the Episcopal church, for whatever reasons, either size, I don't know, decided in the early 1900s that they needed a new facility. And they built the big brick church up on Church Street that's up on the left. And they moved out of here, and the Christian Science Church took this building over. In the 50s, the Christian Science Church had the same sense that they ought to move and establish their own facility. So they built the Royal Barry Wills Church, that's the white church, further up on Church Street on the left as you go up there. And they sold it to the Knights of Columbus, still the same building. Well, it must have been something about this building, because in the 70s, the Knights of Columbus decided that they needed a new facility. And so instead of going and building their own facility off-site, they decided they were going to tear that little church down, and they were going to build their own facility. And so they did tear the church down. And by the way, if you want to see the stained glass window, if you go up to Hadley Hall at the Episcopal Church, it's there in Hadley Hall. And when they tore the building down, did it to construct what you see here, which is a 16,000 square foot building. It's got 8,000 square feet on each floor. It's the footprint of the land here is 11,000 square feet. And you're going to understand that to build this building, they had to go to the town of Winchester and to the Zoning Board of Appeals to get permission to build the building, because the footprint that they had from the old building would not have allowed them to build this building. So they did a land swap with the town, with little slices of land. But the other difficulty they had was the town of Winchester zoning law requires that you have for every four seats you have in a public building, you have to have one parking space. Well, this building doesn't have any parking space it owns. There's nothing contiguous to it where you can build a parking lot. So the deal was at the Zoning Board of Appeals that Knights of Columbus could build the building and the town would have to allow parking. So what does that do for us? We got all the parking in the world. We'll never run out of parking. They plow it, and they always have it plowed before we get in here. And the only time that we ever have a problem as far as it being used up is occasionally there'll be a flea market there. Even with Anchor Fair, which occurs on a Friday and Saturday, they're out of there by Sunday morning. So we've always had our parking there. The building, it can be configured any way we want. All the girders go this way. It's a steel and brick building, a great building. You probably wouldn't be able to build it today since it's so close to a waterway. We had a significant problem with flooding about 7-8 years ago when, because of all the construction in areas like Billerica and Chelmsford north of here, what's happened is when you cut down trees and put macadam over large areas of land, you get a lot of runoff, and the rivers aren't sufficiently large to take the volume of water coming down, so you get an overflow. And so this little river out here, about 8 years ago, if you know that little bridge over here, the water was up over all the openings under that bridge. And when I walked out there in the middle of the night, because we were down here siphoning water off the floor, there were about six of us, and we did it from about 10 at night to about 4 in the morning until they cut the electricity. We had all these little shop vacs. And that bridge was, there was a crack in it. It was moving back and forth. And I just figured at some point the bridge was going to go because it was such a force, the water flowing through there. I mean, I don't know if you've been around a river that really is over flood level, but it was really quite a force. Well, that problem has been solved by one of our a couple that was here left a gift for the church, a very substantial gift that allowed us to put a French drain around here, and so we now have a sump pump over here that pumps everything out once the water comes up. But at the level of water here, we're right close to the river, and it doesn't take much for that river to come up and be pressing water against the bottom of this building. So that problem has been solved. As far as cost of the building, we paid $1,150,000 for the building. It was probably, at the time, it was probably worth $1,250,000. We saved the $100,000 because it was a private sale. There wasn't any realtor involved. We dealt directly with the Knights of Columbus. And we put $800,000 down, and we took out a $550,000 mortgage, of which we used $350,000. So $800,000 plus $350,000 is $1,150,000. And then, in addition, we put $150,000 into the building itself in terms of cleanup. You have to understand that this room you're in was the clubhouse for the KSC. And as at most clubhouses, it had a bar that ran from that door to that door. So there's a long bar all along that wall. And there were about four TVs up here and a pool table over there. And this place was coated with nicotine. All of the ceiling, it was a typical clubhouse. This building was the largest function hall in Winchester. I took my kids down here to sign up for Little League and soccer. It was a public facility, and the town looked at it like that, even though it was owned by the Knights of Columbus. The hospital would run its annual meetings here. There was a big kitchen that's not there any longer. I'll mention what happened to that in a minute. But when we took it over, town, you could sense from just people I knew that, gee, you know, something's disappearing from the public culture. And there were people that wanted to use it continue to use it for the purposes for which it had been used. In order to afford the building, the Knights of Columbus had to allow rental functions, and almost every weekend there'd be something on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, wedding receptions and parties. It was well used. I was here for a football banquet with my son. I mean, it was quite an actively used facility. You have to go to places like Woburn to get anything that's comparable in terms of size. It had a dance floor on the first floor where we meet. And so when we came in here, even though structurally it's in pretty good shape, and cosmetically it was in tough shape. This room in particular, there were two other bars, one up around where the seminar room is now, and one in what we now call the nursery. There was a sauna over here where you could hit golf balls and take a sauna. They had one of the largest liquor supplies in Eastern Massachusetts. On that wall, if you look, when you come in the back door, if you look up, you'll see an area that's all bricked in. Well, that's where the trucks would back in and unload all the hard liquor, and the beer was kept down in the room at the end here where Gail Mills and Dan O'Leary have their Sunday school class. So it was really an overused building, and when we got in here in August of 1997, we had to do a lot of cleanup. And so almost every night for about a month before we occupied in September 1997, there were a crew of about 12 to 15 people down here. It was a great time because you get to work with people. We'd come down around 6 and be, 10, painting walls, pulling up carpet. All these tiles are all new. I mean, I cut a lot of these myself, and it was quite a project, and we did a lot of work. That whole nursery room was built out at that time, and we got the upstairs so that we could, some people wanted to retain the dance floor, but we pulled that up and put down carpeting. And we had a huge kitchen over here where the office area is now, and it had pizza ovens in it and huge sinks. And so this was quite a facility. And in 2001, we paid off that $550,000 mortgage. So you're not facing a big mortgage. If you decide to sign up with us, we don't have that mortgage. We got another one. In 2002, we decided we really needed a better kitchen than what they had, and we needed offices for the staff, and we didn't need that big, ugly kitchen up there that was all tiled, and it was an institutional kitchen. It was just space that we weren't using. So we took out a $200,000 equity line of credit to do roughly $167,000 worth of renovations, some of them done by people in the church, but some of which we paid for. So we did the whole kitchen, and then we did the offices up there, and the baptismal tank. Those were all added. Prior to that time, we were doing our baptisms at the First Baptist Church across the way. Of that $200,000 line, which we still have, we've probably got about $64,000 on it now. It's our over and short account. Although we have to watch Ian and Todd as far as whether or not they're spending too much of it on their own personal needs. In September of, so Todd, excuse me, Ray is here. We've had a series of, in 98 we started thinking about youth, and we have had several people who have acted as youth ministers. And in 2004, we needed to hire someone to be our youth minister. We had a program that started fairly well, and then it was sort of on the skids a little bit and needed reinvigorating. So we did another search for a youth minister and decided at this point we'd try to get a seminary graduate who had some experience with youth ministry, because it's very hard to get youth ministers up here. I don't know why that is. You talk to people in the South and they say, oh, gee, they're all over the place. But certainly up here it's hard to find good youth ministers. And so we decided to take that tack to try to hire someone who was in seminary, who had youth experience, but who was looking for a focus that would be beyond youth experience. And our church, as they already said, my wife and I were interested in evangelism, but our emphases have been evangelism as a steering committee, as well as elders, has always been that we'd be heavily involved in evangelism, discipleship, a heavy missions emphasis, really encourage people to go to the mission field and to support them, and even do offer to educate people who needed financial assistance to go to seminary, to go into the missions field, and also have a strong emphasis on planting. And So we told, in our job description, we said that we were hiring someone who would fit into some of our objectives, including church planting. And a fellow named Michael Davis, who was out at the Moody Graduate School, was our the person who answered our call to come here as the youth minister, and had a heavy, strong interest in church planting. I mean, that was really what his focus was, and that attracted him to come be with us. So we told him that, you know, for a period of time, probably a couple of years, we wanted him to try to take our youth program to the next level, and Michael did that. He's a really effective youth leader. And while he was doing that, he started a little group over at the Barnes & Noble with an emphasis on reaching 20s and 30s for Christ and discipling them. And that grew into something called Genesis, which met down here for a long time, for about a year. And then about 4 years ago, it started meeting upstairs. And then the possibility of planting Genesis, which was about 100 people at this point, 85 to 100 people, and they were meeting in the evening. It's about 6 o'clock at night, wasn't it? Yeah, 6 o'clock at night. And so the launch committee was established, and it was finally decided by all concerned that it would be a good idea to plant Genesis. So in September of 2009, Genesis went, found their own facility in Woburn and moved over to Woburn, and now they're meeting there. And they've been there for almost a year and a half. So Michael was first our youth pastor, then the leader of Genesis, as well as slash youth pastor, and then Genesis elder, and finally pastor of Genesis, an independent church. So we've made good through Michael on one of our initial emphases way back then in 93, which was to plant churches. And we really don't want, as a board of elders and as a church, to build anything bigger than this. And we can hold 350 people upstairs, and if people have a God's leading to establish another church, that's something we're very predisposed toward doing. And it goes back to something I said earlier about how do we impact this culture? How do you get in touch with people? Just a little sidelight along that line. My wife used to run a Pioneer Girls group. You probably have heard of what that's like, Awana. We had four children, and our two eldest daughters were daughters. And when they were about six or eight, she ran a Pioneer Girls group for Sarah and Julie and their friends here in Winchester. But it was an adjunct of the Grace Chapel Pioneer Girls group because of the resources that Ruth could tie into there. But you get to a point where the Pioneer Girls group in fifth and sixth grade becomes a little more intensive, a little more field trips and that sort of thing. And so you need to be sort of on site to access those things. You can't really do it as a separate unit. And so when I think Sarah was in fifth grade, so the girls are two or three years older, the group, which was about 10 when they were here, Ruth said, okay, we're going to go over to Grace and meet over with the people at Grace every week. And as opposed to the 10 that we had meeting in our basement, only two of them went over the hill with our girls. It really does make all sorts of sense to be doing things on site. Now, our church now is more like 40% Winchester and 60% out of town. That's fine. We're fine with that. But as a couple, but you have to decide where you live, how you're going to best impact your area. And planting is one way you can do it. It's not the only way, but it certainly is one way. In addition to Michael, Ian Whitfield has been our community life elder since September 2007. Of course, now our youth minister is David King, and he's been doing it for 2.5 years.
About. And more.
Okay, and he's at Gordon Conwell, and he's finishing a master's at Gordon this spring. And then Patty Fleming is our office administrator. And Patty has been doing that for about 5 years. The building right now, one little factor, if you, I don't know if anyone has an interest, but the building right now is probably worth about $2 million on the market. And it would be easy to sell this place because it's any commercial enterprise could use this very easily for office space. We're non-denominational, we have been ever since we started. The reason for that is that when you get together and try to start a church, there's so many things you got to do. Just administratively and logistically, that and people come from different backgrounds. All the people that started the church were from Grace Chapel, and if you've been to a church like Grace Chapel, which is they'd refer themselves interdenominational, it's more or less the same thing. You get people from different backgrounds, different emphases, so you start talking about denominations, and you quickly find there are just different feelings about, you know, about how that works out. And some people have definite feelings about, I don't want to be part of that. So we just never really got involved in that discussion. We had a few thoughts, Free Church, PCA, but it never really got what was something that we were able to address. There are pros and cons, obviously. If you're tied in with a denomination, you have all the resources they can offer, like their missionaries. They've already screened them all. We have to screen our own missionaries. We have a missions committee that does that. I probably Todd and Ian will be talking about who our missionaries are, but we've got 16 or 17 missionaries and missionary organizations, and all of those have been screened by people here. Well, the denomination provides you with those missionaries. The denomination helps you with your searches. We do all our own searches. Our method has been to contact seminaries and get on the internet, and there's some internet sources that make it a lot easier. Resources in terms of money. Some denominations offer money when you're starting a church. We never had that. So there are definite pluses, but there are the minuses. I mean, some people don't like certain denominations, and so therefore won't even come in your church if that's on your church logo. So anyway, there was no decision made not to be affiliated with a specific denomination, as much as we never got around to it. And it's an important subject, but it's just hard to accomplish everything that you might like to do theoretically. We're an elder form of government, as Ian and Todd will be talking about later. And we early on decided that God, his word would say that we should be a male-only elder board. We instituted an operating committee in 1998. That is just like a board of deacons. Bob Zickel has always been the chairman of that. Bob Zickel is Mr. Everything as far as the care of this building. He has just done a huge amount to keep this place in the shape it is. He's had various people working on it with him who have been helpful. And right now, Elaine and Greg Holt, Steve St. Germain, David Fleming, Patty Fleming, unrelated, are on that committee. And they are concerned with the upkeep and the repair of this facility, and they do a great job. So if there are things that you're concerned about, light bulbs or leaks or toilets that need fixing, that's the group of people you got to talk to, and not the elders. And that was one reason it was done. And that's very biblical, because as you know, back in the early church, they had to make sure who was going to feed the widows, and so it's the same issue. It's the same issue Moses had when his father-in-law told him, you've got to break this, your responsibilities down and start delegating. And so that's a delegation. The bylaws call for deacons. The operating committee is basically functioning in that role. Okay, I've said about all I want to say about history. If anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. No questions.
So, elaborate more on the deacons. The elders are very, you are able to understand the elders very well because they're so visible. But what, do you have a process of selecting a deacon? Why don't you call them deacons? And are women able to be deacons?
Okay, we've got several questions. Okay, one, the last question is yes.
Great.
Number two, there was someone on the elder board, no longer on the elder board, who had a problem with calling it, calling deacons, particularly since all the rest of us felt that there was no problem with women serving as deacons because Phoebe was a deacon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used, it's a euphemism, we used operating committee instead of deacons. I'm uncomfortable with that because the bylaws, which I had something to do with drafting, says deacons, and but that's the history behind that.
Okay.
Functioning, they take care of the budgeting.
Uh-huh.
They literally take care of all of the maintenance. There can be big maintenance problems around here. We've got four big HVAC units on the roof. One of them is a problem right now, and that means you've got to get, that's a $20,000 number. I mean, we're talking big money when you're talking about facility upkeep. They honchoed all of the renovations here. I mean, we did it, everyone pitched in, but renovations would be there within their bailiwick. They've just done the carpeting in the youth room. You ought to look at that. It's unique. I've never seen it before. Maybe it's been around. Maybe it's just me. But it's squares of carpet that are put down. And so if one of them is soiled or can't be used anymore, you can pick up that square and replace it rather than have to replace the whole carpet. So that's a test run for doing it in here because this is the next room. We've already appropriated the money. And so they have to decide what carpet they're going to use in here. So if you have, if you don't like that carpet or you like it, express your views to Bob Zickel and that committee because they're deciding right now what they're going to do in here. And they're in charge of making sure that we have the luncheon food that we need and keeping that kitchen in order, although other people who use it are supposed to help out with that. There's some overlap there as far as some of the functions.
Can I just add that I think we would add ministry team leaders to that deacon equivalent. And your question is a good one. We don't have a formal procedure like we do for elder discernment. We
right.
don't have a formal procedure, but we have an effective procedure of trying to figure out who is qualified to lead a team or to be part of that operating committee.
So the elders are men, but teachers can be women?
Yes.
Teachers of adults?
Yes.
And be women?
Yeah, and they're probably going to get into this issue. We not only allow, I think it's entirely appropriate for women to serve in any other role other than elder, but we, over time, will allow someone who's not a member who we think is qualified to teach. And there are some people, for whatever reason, don't become members and yet want to teach. And so we do that as well.
Okay. And the elders are men because of the example in the Bible? Because
right.
there's no female example in the Bible?
Well, that's a long discussion, but
it is.
It's basically the emphasis of the Bible as far as roles. It has nothing to do with us, a male or female before the Lord. It's a question of how does the Bible specifically
sure,
create
we,
specific roles?
Right. We come from a Church of Christ background,
mm-hmm.
Which is, this is very, it's a big thing, and that's one mm-hmm. of the reasons why we left the Church of Christ.
Yeah.
So, okay.
I think they're probably going to address that a little later, though.
Okay.
My job is mostly history.
Since the church has a heart to plant churches, you know, we talked a lot about the process of people who are at Grace Chapel, and
mm-hmm.
just maybe just two or three words on how did you communicate with the leadership of that church, and was there you know, an understanding that, hey, we're going to try to do that. I'm just kind of curious, because I know that if you do that in the wrong way, it can create a lot of friction. So if you could comment on what you did to try to make sure it was a healthy plant or a, you know, positive thing.
Okay, well, we basically did all this on our own. At the time we left, Grace Shaw was going through a transition as far as senior pastor, and we're planting, had already started planting to plant Grace Community Church in Chelmsford. So they were already 6 or 8 months into that plan, and so they weren't interested in taking on another one anyway, financially or planning wise. So this was something that the people who were on the steering committee did on our own. But Andy Mills was the moderator. I was an elder. We were all tied in. So we knew all the movers and shakers anyway, and we just decided it was the right thing we should do, and we didn't want the emphasis there, having been on those committees for a long time, was build a bigger church. And the only reason that Grace Community and other churches were planted was they just kept being frustrated. They'd get options on property in places like Lincoln, and then it turned out it wasn't feasible to build on them for one reason or another, all during the time I was that we were there, particularly from the late 70s to the early 90s. So it's such a large church that as one of our friends said, who we met later, who had been fairly involved, you know, they'd left and they said, you know, I don't think anyone even misses me because they don't know I'm gone. I mean, if you're not really involved in the inner circle there, it's very easy just to be a number at a place like Grace. And we were there when it was maybe 1,500 to 1,700. It's about 3,200 now.
So it'd be different. Church of 200 and
that's right.
People left.
It's that's right. Right. Yeah. I mean, okay. There were three services when we left. I mean, it's just there were some key people that were involved in our group. I think there are people that, you know, wonder what our emphasis was, but certainly, you know, as far as Ruth and I were concerned, it was something that we always wanted to do, and we're just where we thought we should be in the interim, being at Grace. Any other questions? Sorry.
So I've always wondered about the title teaching elder, that, you know, that in other churches I've been a part of, that would usually be called the preacher or the pastor or, mm-hmm. or some variation of head minister.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a semantic difference, or is that a choice that tells us something about that role that's different from the other names?
Well, there are a lot of things that could be said about that, but one is that there are various forms of church governance you can have. There's the congregational model, which typically will have a senior pastor, and the senior pastor is pretty much the person who has the policies that are adopted by the board. It's not necessarily the rubber stamp, but he'll listen to the board, but you brought him in as the idea guy. That's one format. That would be the Grace Chapel or Park Street format. An elder model is another model. This church was designed in a way that was supposed to come close to the New Testament model. And so a group of elders, plurality of elders, who are all equals, who all share the decision making of a church body, but what we've done is, rather than call Todd a pastor, though, we've called him a teaching elder, because he's one of the elders that is set aside. We've given him the time to devote to teaching, and Todd is a community life elder because he's been set aside to spend a lot of time in the pastoral duties. Does quite a bit of administrative stuff, but the flavor of that title is that he's going to relate to people and do the pastoral side of. Todd does a lot of pastoral ministry as well, but his major emphasis is the teaching. And occasionally you'll hear other elders preaching, just like Ian does. So it's really just meant to emphasize the elder form of governance and the fact that he's the one of the elders that's has that teaching function. But in another format, in another scenario, if we were a senior pastor model, he would be the pastor. Just like Genesis, Michael Davis is more comfortable in the senior pastor model, and he is the pastor of Genesis. He was an elder before we planted it, an elder of Genesis, but he's now the pastor of Genesis. Russ?
Could you be a, could you call a pastor and him not be an elder?
We probably wouldn't, because we're the criterion for being a pastor would be the same as being an elder. So to be, and the confusion comes because almost everybody else in Christianity calls their head person a pastor. We're trying to be consistent within the church, and so if we started doing that, that we're mixing. We're really confusing people. So we usually call them, you know, for instance, David King. We use the word minister of children, or how do we?
Director of youth ministry.
Yeah, something like that. But don't worry too much about titles. It's what the essence of what the person is doing.
I just wondered if that could be that way.
I think that the general. Because there's so much confusion between pastor and elder, we try to stay away from the term pastor and use elder to try to be consistent with the form that of governance we're using.
There is some more detail on this. We're going to spend some time on this later on.
So when you sit down in a meeting of elders,
yes,
the opinions and votes of Ian and Todd are the same as the other elders.
That's right.
Oh, it's less, actually.
that's right, but that is correct, although just differences in personality and strength of character, you know, maturity sometimes do, you know, weigh in when people are making decisions, but theoretically that's true.
And is there currently an odd number or an even number of elders?
Right now we have 6 elders. Before Paul Fleming left and Michael left, we had 7. Well, Paul Fleming became an elder over at Genesis.
And do you have to come to unanimity, or is it four guys have to say yes on something and 2 can abstain or something like that?
Well, I think they're going to get into this, but I'll make a short answer. There are 2 votes that have to be unanimous. On the Board of Elders, any new elder, it's going to be a unanimous vote, and any deacon is going to be a unanimous vote. Anything else, it's a consensus, which usually means majority vote. Very few of our votes are not unanimous votes. And usually, just because here we're elders for life, unless you get kicked out or you decide to resign for some reason. And so it's you get to know each other pretty well, and so in any discussion you get a sense of where people are at, and sometimes you'll accede to their wishes and vote against your predilection. And so it's very seldom we don't have a unanimous vote. And so if we don't, and that also says that if someone feels very strongly about something, you're going to give that a lot of weight. I think they're going to handle the governance issues more thoroughly, aren't you? Yeah. So they'll get into that. Any other questions? That bored you to death? All right. Well, if you have any other questions, either today, I'll stick around for a few minutes, or during any time around church, you'll be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. 4 minutes to stretch our legs and hit the restroom, and then we'll come back for part 2.
Just to encourage directness, but give freedom to.
We have a minute, 5.